This is Whitley Strieber, and this is Dreamland. You've reached the edge of the world.
Welcome back to Dreamland. I'm your guest host, Kelly Chase. Whitley Strieber will be back next week. Today, I'm joined by Elliot Hauser, who I first met at the Archives of the Impossible conference earlier this month, where he spoke on a panel exploring the metadata experiencer study involving the Anne and Whitley Strieber letters and the John E. Mack archives. We had a great conversation there, and I'm excited to continue it here with all of you. Elliot is a researcher and a technologist whose work examines how information systems shape our social realities. He holds a PhD in information science from the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, and he's currently co-lead of Living and Working with Robots, a multidisciplinary project at UT Austin that uses socio-technical methods to study how humans and robots interact. If you want to hear more about the metadata study itself, be sure to check out my recent interview with Kim Engels. But for now, without further ado, here is my conversation with Elliot Hauser. Hi, Elliot. Welcome to Dreamland. It's so great to have you.
Hey, likewise. Very, very glad to be having this conversation with you.
Well, I had such a great time meeting you at Archives of the Impossible. I had been really looking forward to the panel that you and your colleagues did. Obviously, I spoke to Kim Engels, who's working with you on the metadata project at the Archives of the Impossible last month. And I'm just so intrigued by the whole thing. And, you know, you have a very special role to play in that as well. And so I think maybe one of the more difficult parts. So there's a lot of moving parts, but it's the stuff you're thinking through is really challenging. So I was excited to talk with you in person and super excited to have this conversation here. So how about before we start, if you could just maybe introduce yourself, let people know a little bit about you and how you came to be involved in this study that's going on at the archives.
Absolutely. So I'm an assistant professor of information studies at University of Texas at Austin. I guess in general, my kind of research is into how information shapes reality, how we come to know things, what we think is true, what's possible in terms of what we can do, what's possible in terms of what we perceive to be possible. But not really before this project in the context of the phenomenon or of experiencers. I've been pursuing this in the past few years in a transdisciplinary robotics context. So UT Austin has one of the top robotics programs in the world. And so when I showed up here, the kind of participatory, collaborative way of working that we kind of have in this field was a great fit with some of the robotics initiatives that were going on on campus. And so I was able to join and help build some collaborations between social scientists and technologists about autonomous robots operating on campus. And so, part of a still doing that work, part of a big cross-campus collaboration that's deploying robots on campus, wheeled robots, quadruped robots, in a variety of different settings. And my role and the role of the social scientists who I kind of advocated for and were joined the team is to help keep the focus, enable the team to understand the effects of these technologies and the experiences that they induced on the pedestrians who typically, right, even in robotics research, human-robot interaction is a part of that, not the full thing. And there's a lot of focus on the user, right? The person who is using the robot to do something, directly interacting with it. But the more kind of incidental or unplanned encounters that happen with pedestrian robotics are an area of emerging research. And, since joining that project, UT Austin has become one of a few in growing number of places around the world that are looking at that. In terms of kind of maybe more germane to our shared interests, I do a variety of, maybe happenstance, synchronicity perhaps, just became aware of online communities of experiencers. And this wasn't part of research. It was just kind of more just browsing Reddit or something, kind of after work, blown off steam or, you know, relaxing a little bit. And then kind of slowly coming to realize the sincerity and that really in these experiences, I saw people and didn't understand the experiences. And certainly in the beginning kind of wasn't inclined to, you know, believe random people on the internet saying that, that things that I didn't understand had happened to them. But really just in part due to the research methods and the epistemology that we have in our field that are, I think have gotten quite sophisticated in the study of science and technology from a social lens, really came to realize that none of my kind of, that these are people, these are their experiences. And then slowly kind of getting more and more fascinated by this, I realized that for reasons of self-preservation in academia on the tenure track, it was time to figure out how I could deploy my research skills in this. And so I reached out to Jeff Kripal, amongst others, but I sent him a cold email. And, you know, it took him like a month to get back to me. And he kind of replied, you know, on a plane, "Hey, I'm really busy. You know, what you're doing sounds interesting." But eventually he connected me with Karin Austin, and they were kind of understandably, they're very busy, right? Already engaged in this project. And, you know, I had some other ideas for collaboration, but as they kind of read me into what they were doing, and I kind of was able to tell them about my skills and my experience and things like that, it worked out to be a really great collaboration. So kind of slowly joined the project and really started working in earnest on it just in January 2025. And here we are. As you mentioned, in April, we got to have that panel at the Archives Impossible conference and really share with a broader audience the things that we were working on and the vision that we have that is getting bigger. We were just so delighted that so many people in the audience and other speakers kind of recognized that vision and recognized the kind of timeliness of it.
Yeah, I think it's so exciting. And also for anyone who's listening, I actually find the work that you're doing with robotics to be very interesting and actually, I think, relevant in a lot of ways. So for anyone who is like, don't skip over that, I promise we're coming back to it.
Wonderful.
But yeah, let's continue on with the archive stuff. So kind of, can you help explain to people specifically the kinds of problems that you were brought in to help them deal with? Because it turns out that the more you guys talked about this project, the more I realized that it's far more complicated than maybe it sounds on its surface.
Absolutely. Well, I want to say that Darren King has been a great advisor on this project and really set up the project well in terms of, you know, providing the technical expertise of what was possible and how to shape the vision. So he deserves a huge amount of credit for the kind of vision that we share. The thing that I was, I think I've successfully kind of added to the vision that was there is that one of the things that we need to encourage research on this topic is the existence of kind of a viable research infrastructure. And that's one of the ways in which I've participated in robotics research is to help with methodologies, help with just the kind of experimental design, the access to data, the access to capacity, research capacity of various kinds that enables different kinds of research to get done than are the case now. And, you know, in science, the field of, you know, it's kind of an anachronistic term these days, right? But cyber infrastructure is the National Science Foundation's kind of name for this. And this is things like, you know, how to share, you know, petabytes of astrological data, or how to manage massive amounts of genome sequences or things like that. Those are all research infrastructure projects that enable new kinds of scientific inquiry. And of course, in Archives of the Impossible, it's not just science, right? There's a multidisciplinary approach to it. And having my undergraduate background is art history and philosophy. And so I've, and really information studies is kind of an interdiscipline in ways that I think is good. Sometimes it you know, people are like, well, what's your field? I need a paragraph or a few minutes sometimes to communicate, to answer that question, right? We don't, there aren't a department of information or a school of information at every school. But nonetheless, being familiar with many different ways of knowing and transdisciplinary areas of working together, whatever kind of inquiry you want to happen in academics, a great way to intervene in that and to enable it and to ensure that it's rigorous and that more than just one researcher, more than just one team even can do this sort of thing is to kind of construct a shared research infrastructure. So infrastructure in that sense, in the kind of NSF's definition, isn't just technology. It's not computers. It is sometimes those things. It's often those things too. But it's also data. Data is a part of infrastructure. Anything that's required to help the science happen. It's also know-how. The ability to operate instruments or to transform data or to analyze data, things like that. And so adding that infrastructural perspective to the vision that that this team had, I think it both augments the kind of research that we want to do as a team, but it's also an invitation, not quite ready to be sent yet, because there's a lot of work in between us and inviting other people to utilize the things that we're doing and to access the data that comes from the archive, things like that. But that's the goal. And so open data will come out of this, methods will come out of this, research will come out of this, but ultimately will enable new kinds of research by other teams that in the beginning, it might be people that we've met, right? People that we've interested in this, but eventually they won't need to be a front door, right? They'll be able to access the data or the tools or the code themselves and do independent inquiry.
Very cool. So for anyone who's listening who isn't familiar with the project or who's not quite sure what we're talking about, and correct me if I'm wrong, the point of this archives study and what you guys are doing and kind of parsing all this information is you have the John Mack archives and you have the Whitley Strieber letters. And a lot of this stuff isn't able to be shared publicly because it has a lot of personal information and personal data in there that people don't necessarily want to have shared. But it's also this treasure trove of information about firsthand experiences that people have had. And so you guys are working on, like, how do we extract the information out of this without divulging people's personal information, like making it usable and searchable and all of those things in a way that it's just not now in these boxes. So for anyone who's interested, the conversation with Kim Engels, she talked a lot about phenomenology and how all of that works. But what are some
of our conference talks should be up in a week or two, I would estimate.
Oh, great.
So that'll be up soon so people can get some background. But first of all, you did an excellent job of starting from the beginning as I didn't. So thank you for that.
Oh, no worries.
But I'll come in a little bit. I'm sorry for interrupting you, but comment a bit on what is it? So the Mack and Strieber collections in Archives of the Impossible far exceed just these letters. But the letters are the focus of this study because the letters and the interview transcripts, but I'll come back to that in a sec, right? These are first-person accounts of these anomalous experiences that happened before the internet, right? And are, you know, those of us on the research team that are familiar with contemporary accounts or that have, I don't identify as an experiencer, but, you know, people on the team certainly are, right? And they can recognize pattern match, right? Oh, yeah, of course, right? There are patterns to these experiences in these letters. And the Strieber letters come from, you know, 1987 to the early 90s. The Mack letters are something like 96 to the 2000s, right? There's some overlap in those readerships, but not full. And so the patterns that we can kind of find in there are going to be really informative in terms of that phenomenological catalog of kind of what are the experiences. There's also interpretations in there. People have different interpretations of what the experiences mean, where they come from, things like that. But Kim is really expert on the team that's focusing us just on the experiences. Now, the letters, the unredacted letters, yeah, they would have personal information of people. If there's someone who still lives at the same address, or regardless, somebody currently lives at that address, that's not appropriate data for us to kind of release. And so from a research ethics standpoint, we want to make sure that we can capture as much of the research value and offer that in an open way, in the form of open data, to the community as we can, while avoiding any of the harms that we might be able to anticipate that could come to people in the letters or other people. And so that balancing of research value and mitigation of harm is the general form of research data ethics. And so for the letters, we have an aspiration. This is new, I think, since me joining. I'm very optimistic that we will be able to sufficiently anonymize the letters such that we could release that as an open data corpus. There's a lot of caveats to that, and of course we won't do that if we can't sufficiently do that. But I talked about in my conference talk that we're going to try to do that in a community engaged way, and to solicit participation from experiencers in the community to help us identify both the research value, because we're researchers, right? But we all have different disciplines, and people in the experiencer community can inform our understanding of what the potential value and where that might be located in this data, and then also the potential harms. And that's best practice for this kind of research, social research with specific communities. And so we'll open as much data as we can that kind of meets that threshold of research data ethics. The interview transcripts, kind of by contrast, I don't think it's likely that we'll be able to sufficiently anonymize those, because there are multiple kind of sequential interviews of hundreds of experiencers that was in a pseudo clinical context. And, you know, there's just a lot in there that's, I think, too sensitive to be anonymized. If we can figure that out, and, you know, there's a way we get pleasantly surprised, right, that a good portion of those we're able to release without harming people, then that could be a conversation with, that we can have at that time. But absolutely, the releasing, or maybe excerpting, right, or extracting, long quotes that are just the experience and don't have the kind of history or background or emotional issues or anything else that's personally identifiable or that's sensitive in those interview transcripts, that'll undoubtedly, right, meet that that criteria of having great research value and no expected harm to anybody. So that's the kind of formula that we apply to this. And as this project grows and as other kind of first-person accounts of anomalous experiences kind of enter this kind of pipeline, we'll need in many cases to start again, potentially with a new group of solicited contributions from experiencers to have that conversation about research value and potential harms.
We're going to take a quick break and we'll be right back. Yeah, it's so something that I was really struck by in your talk is, like, you had some really great visualizations to just show how, first of all, how just like how much data you're dealing with just in this.
It's a lot.
And even that is just a subset of this like much larger bit of data that you have at the archives. But then even that just represents this, like, you know, the Streber letters, which are like a very particular, like they're both gold mines, but they're also both very particular cases. Like, they're not necessarily representative of like anomalous experience as a whole. It's like you've got this like time period from decades ago and like very specific people. And like, there's so much that we can glean from that, and information that like we haven't been able, it's been kind of locked up inside of those archives that we're trying to get out. But it just made me recognize like how large the problem is in terms of us making long-term progress in understanding anomalous experience, because like, how do you even begin to get to something like a representative sample of people who are having like really strange experiences, right?
Yeah. No, this is great. And this is someplace where I think these kind of social studies of science and technology offer a viable path forward, right? So, social science of science, started in the 60s or so as kind of a field, and then kind of quickly, kind of social science and technology was added, you know, maybe in more like the 70s. And they're very well-developed fields. You might imagine, right, like there is no one sociology of science, right? Because science is so many things. There's no one sociology of technology, because technology is so many things, right? And so there's an expectation and understanding that the understandings that we do have are scoped, right? And so, you know, when Bruno Latour and Steve Woolgar, you know, published this, a seminal book called Laboratory Life, right? And they went to a specific lab and studied it, right, ethnographically, of how it worked. There are things that they found that are characteristic of places that they didn't study. And that's one of the value that you get from, it's one of the metrics of value of social research is how transferable is it and what parts of it are transferable. But the richness that they had of going to that specific place and going to this, to getting the kind of specificity of it with an eye towards ways in which that was an expression of broader phenomena in the scientific sense, little p sense, right? Broader phenomena in that those kinds of sites. Similar to, you know, sociology of technology of there's some early studies on multi-user dungeons, right? Or like bulletin board systems and the kind of proto internet, right? Or Usenet, right? There's great seminal works that are about technological spaces that no longer exist. And yet you can find some of the phenomena of modern social networks already visible at that moment and things that are totally specific to the context. And I think when we think about the nature of conscious experience and these kind of, you know, extraordinary experiences, they are very prevalent. They're not niche things, right? It's not only Whitley Strieber's readers or only John Mack's readers that have experiences like this. Certainly the windows that the Strieber letters and the Mack letters kind of open up to it are so rich. The idea of richness, right, is very amenable to that kind of contextualized explanation and understanding. And then the kind of open question of how those understandings, how and whether those understandings are transferable. I can tell you heuristically right now that a lot of the things that I see in letters that were written by, you know, somebody from Iowa in, you know, 1988 to Whitley Strieber, like it's on Reddit right now in contemporary communities. And so there's, but you know, it's going to take time to be able to unpack that and to demonstrate that and to do research on that and certainly to interpret what that might mean. But the richness of all of these different data sets, that's kind of the program of research for a field. It's got to be more than one study. It's got to certainly be more than one researcher. And ideally, as these sorts of studies, like the one Kim published in Phenomenology and Religion, I believe it was the journal over the fall, as these studies come out, different scholars are going to see things that they recognize, they see things that they know how to work with in experiencer communities. And I think that will be a good thing to get more eyes, more ways of knowing, studying more contexts. But it's really just the beginning. This, I'll put it this way, right? If this is a lacuna in our understanding of human experience more broadly, then kind of all of academia needs to get involved, right? It's a big, big thing. And so expecting representativeness kind of as such, there's very little that we can say about technology as such. And so experiencers as such, we're going to need a lot more adjectives in front of that to be able to, right, to say things that that are going to hold water.
Yeah, no, I'm so fascinated by that. And just, and it's exciting and inspiring and also a little overwhelming to realize just how much work there is to do. You know, I got the pleasure of spending some time down in the archives when we were filming for Cosmosis. And, you know, Jay was down there kind of, of course we were like working all day. So we didn't actually get to like look through anything. So at the end of the day, we're like, we're going to read one Strieber letter before we go. So, nice. You know, we each opened a box and like grabbed one and we're like, we're going to enjoy this. But Jay just randomly, the one that he pulled out ended up being for somebody who had was living in a town that was like very near to a town that he was living in the same year that he had had an experience like very nearby. I want to say it was Indiana or something like that. Wow. And it just, that even made me think of just like, could those things have been related? Are there greater patterns? But the fact that we don't have places to, you know, we don't have like repositories of this information. We don't have, people don't even have an understanding that this could be real. And half the time they just ignore that it ever happened in the first place. And so, you know, what are the chances that he would even find that letter? And then, you know, how much of the signal are we missing? And because we just don't have the data in the right way, like in the right place and in the right configuration for us to like do something with it.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. Well, first of all, I'm really glad that you got a chance to read some of the letters. I mean, that was certainly something as we were kind of preparing our presentation for the conference, you know, we kind of sat down and looked around each other, like, let's make sure that we quote experiencers, that we put images that they've made, right, that experiencers are centered. And that's a heuristic from social research in general, right? You want to let your participants kind of speak when you're doing that form of research. And it can be overwhelming, but this is one of the great strengths that different fields of academia that I don't think have been applied to the experiencer studies or studies of UAPs, social scientists are very comfortable with and used to working with things that far exceed anything a single researcher, right, could understand, right? So like scientific objectivity, you know, there's like papers and papers and books written about scientific objectivity. It's this massive thing. And the kind of the methods and the ways of knowing of social science are really good at taking things that just feel overwhelming and giving us some traction so we can work with them. There's a nice handoff once things are broken down enough that different kinds of research, like you could formulate a hypothesis, right, that could be true or false. But this is the kind of the other half of academic inquiry, deductive inquiry, where you have a theory, you have a hypothesis, you want to test it. That's amazing. That's a big part of what we do in academia broadly. But generating theories, generating hypotheses, having something to test, that comes from this more kind of inductive type approach where you look at the data, you find patterns, you identify phenomena or anomalies that need to be explained, and you advance local explanations that then could be tested. Oh, I don't know. This person said that this seemed to explain that local observation. Does it work over here? And start building from the kind of bottom up. They work together in a healthy and functioning kind of intellectual community, which there do exist in academia. There are plenty of them. We get caricatured, right, as, you know, having these pitched battles of qualitative versus quantitative or stuff. But I think there are plenty of us that have great respect and who use multiple methodologies.
Absolutely. I think something that strikes me, also struck me a little bit funny during your talk, is just that, like, I unfortunately spend a lot of time on like UFO Twitter and other places. And so I inevitably see the people who are like pounding their fists and saying, you know, where's the evidence? We don't have any evidence. And it's like, I don't think you know what evidence means, because we have so much evidence that like, right, we have to like bring in specialists to be like, how are we going to deal with all of this evidence so that we can use it in a proper way? But it seems like it's just a real lack of understanding just about, you know, the basic scientific method and how one might go about utilizing evidence and that sort of thing.
You know, we kind of shared across us in our it was all kind of five different people. Karen Austin, who's the executive director of John Mack Institute and the kind of project manager of the archives. Amanda Fokey, who's head of special collections at Rice, and, you know, is a professional research archivist. Then Kim Ingalls, who you had on a week or two ago. And Charles Yokoyama, who's a neuroscientist, and I, right? Those are the five people on the panel, for anyone who didn't see it. And a kind of running theme that we took and ran with is Jeff Kripal, who's been an intellectual leader and contributor to this project. He wasn't on the panel. And, you know, as you might imagine, he's a very busy person. but he has he stays involved and gives us great great input. He talked about how and Kim talked about this in your interview, right? How sometimes there's okay, let's take off the table everything, right, that doesn't meet a certain standard, right, that we impose, and then say, okay, we can explain everything on the table, and then right, we kind of use that analogy, right, that one of the things of our project is to put these experiences back on the table as things that need explanation. A different way of potentially looking at that is if all you have, if the only thing that you can see are things that are visible with a kind of chosen set of hypotheses, a chosen set of scientific understandings, then the kind of there's this kind of null hypothesis technique, right? It was kind of like, okay, well, then that's probably a mistake, or that's somebody who's lying, or that person, you know, made money off this, and so, you know, they had an ulterior motive, or you know, I'm not a psychiatrist, but that's schizophrenia, or things like that, right? And so the kind of hypothesis of like, you know, this armchair psychiatry makes it into the, you know, the kind of multi-barrel binoculars you try to use. And then other forms of explanation don't make it in. And again, I don't think that as there's as much discord in academia as sometimes it seems from the outside, in part because a lot of the people doing that just kind of saying, okay, we're only going to take this kind of top down things we can understand, look at it, are not actually scientists or not actually academics. They're not actually in it, right? They're just kind of saying they think that all that science gives us is, you know, these kind of binoculars that we can look, and then everything else doesn't exist or is to be explained by uninvented binoculars. Right, that cycle of kind of going and looking at the data itself without necessarily a hypothesis, that's something that all fields of science need to do. In biology, you know, Jane Goodall's studies of chimpanzees, right? Actually, evolutionary biologist Stephen Jay Gould called that one of the crowning achievements of human civilization, is just recognizing the intelligence of non-human primates. And there are many things that Goodall observed, right? Not from a theoretic standpoint, but just observation, right? And so when a chimpanzee, when they have, they demonstrate evidence of a memory of an event that was years ago, or when they have, very refined perceptions of each other's individuality, or they utilize tools, or they transmit behaviors from chimpanzee to chimpanzee, right? What's the p-value of that? No, right? Like those are positive demonstrations that this exists. And then you might go do a lab-based study or other sorts of things to understand more about it. Other things like in machine learning, clustering algorithms, that's inductive logic, right? That's different than something where you have a theory of the dynamics and then you measure it and you get the fit, right? There's multiple ways of knowing embedded in every scientific field, every field of the humanities, every social sciences. I just encourage it. I'm not an apologist for all academics or things like that, but definitely don't think of us as a monolith. I don't even think of us as us in the sense of like, there's enough diversity in my colleagues and things like that, that, you know, being a professor of this or that, there's a lot of different ways of knowing and a lot of deep respect across different fields.
That's very cool. And that's great to hear. And it's really exciting to see this work starting to be really done in academic settings. I think it's really encouraging. I'd love to shift gears a little bit and talk about the other work that you're doing. So first, from a high level, because I find this fascinating, right? That there's this, so maybe you explain first sort of the, what do these experiments look like that you're doing, and what questions are you trying to answer?
Great. So like a good example of one of the things that we do in kind of academics, right, is you might have kind of research program level questions, right? And you know, something like, what's the nature of chimpanzee social intelligence, right? No one study is going to answer that sort of thing. So a version of that is something like, what's it like for a pedestrian to encounter an autonomous robot unexpectedly on the sidewalk, right? In the context of their day. That's something that exceeds any one paper, and in our case, definitely exceeds any one researcher. There's multiple things that we need to know to try and answer aspects of that question. One of the things that I and the other kind of social scientists on the team do is come in and augment the ways that roboticists kind of know about this problem, right? Some of our colleagues are in aerospace engineering or computer science, right? And they are developing robotic autonomy, trying to develop better perception. It's actually much harder than self-driving cars to get a robot to perform well in a pedestrian environment because it's far less structured in terms of what the possible behaviors of a pedestrian are versus a car. And so the field of robot social navigation is a good example of how human factors show up in the technology, right? And there aren't necessarily people with social or psychological training, although certainly the robotics community has that. But oftentimes, roboticists that are very interested in solving hard problems for robotic autonomy will kind of realize, oh, wow, this is a hard problem. I want to get in there and try and solve it, right? And humans have typically developed a nice understanding of what the norms are of, you know, kind of social navigation and, you know, when do you kind of stop and let someone pass? Or, you know, we have all these kind of gestural affordances, right, that we can signal to each other. And we do it typically unconsciously. And so some of the hard problem that our robotics colleagues are doing is trying to develop autonomous systems that can interface with these kind of unstated, unspoken norms of what it's like to navigate successfully and competently on a sidewalk. In addition, right, like, so to do that, they need to understand about people, and they weren't taught in their doctoral programs like we were how to do interviews or how to do, you know, behavioral studies or ethnographic studies or things like that. And so some of what they need to know are things that we can help tell them, right? But also we have our own research interests about how the kind of introduction of technology could change a space, could change social behavior, how media influences might factor into people's experience of kind of what a robot is and how they feel about it. Then similarly, right, we might need robots to do different things, right, autonomously to set up the conditions where we can study some of the research questions that we have. And so that those are the kind of lines of collaboration where different sets of skills enable new kind of mutually beneficial ways of working together. So that's just describing some of how we work together. I will say that in terms of research infrastructure, it's hard to do an in situ study of pedestrian navigation. It's a lot easier to recruit people, bring them into the robotics building, you know, set up a scenario where they have to navigate around a thing or, you know, try and stage something, right? It's not as representative what it's really like on the sidewalk, but it's a lot faster and easier to publish a paper. And you can publish a lot of papers that way. But kind of collectively, one of the things that we've done and the thing that I led for this team is trying to develop new methods to make it easier to do these kind of in situ studies. And it wasn't just me. It's something that where we were kind of asking and kind of collaboratively developing together. Okay, what's this going to be like? And can you do this? And things like that. So some of the things that, you know, we've been doing is make it easier for roboticists to discretely control a robot. That's a method, not just in robotics, but also in human-computer interaction studies. It's called the Wizard of Oz method. Pay no attention to the man behind the curtain. I didn't make that up. It's been for decades. It's been used. It's kind of a fun thing that when people discover that's a research method, right? Wizard of Oz studies, where it's kind of fake autonomy. You are controlling it intelligently as a human, but kind of putting people in a situation where it looks like the system is actually operational and doing those things that you're controlling it to do. And the reason that's important is that sometimes we don't know how to get a robot to gesture, for instance, right? Some of these Boston Dynamics quadruped robots are some of the ones that we work with, right? And they're very expressive. They could do things. And so some of our studies are about getting them to gesture in certain situations and to understand whether it's the right gesture, right? Understand what are the right parameters to produce that. And then potentially go implement that, you know, set that as a task that the people who study robotic autonomy would implement. Well, to do that, we need better, kind of more ergonomic controls for the wizard in the Wizard of Oz study to be able to get the robot to do the right things. And so developing these kind of hybrid forms of autonomy where, certainly no one is kind of telling the robot, the quadruped robot to pick up this foot and pick up that foot or things like that. There's an amount of autonomy that we need them to have. And then the ability to kind of modulate in the experimentally relevant way that lets us do these kind of more what we would call ecologically valid experimental designs where we're doing the experiment out on the street, out on the sidewalk, instead of in the laboratory. And the absence of that sort of thing is a contributor to why this is a kind of poorly understood, relatively, area of robotics.
We'll be right back after this quick break. So I have so many questions.
Bring it on.
Okay. So first of all, what is it like, or like, what have you found so far about what is it like for people when they encounter these autonomous robots just out in the wild?
Yeah, well, so to we published some papers on this, and I want to give a shout out to my doctoral student Yaoqing Chan, who will be graduating next semester. He's kind of made this the focus of his dissertation. Has been a central leader, kind of co-first author on some of our publications on this. But you know, our kind of understanding, one of the things that we did it was a laboratory study. One of our first studies was a laboratory study. They have kind of in the robotics lab, they have these kind of panels that are set up to have like a hallway environment where you can have people encounter a robot, in this case, the Boston Dynamics quadruped, in that kind of controlled setting where you can collect a lot of data, right? And then you have them kind of fill out surveys and might vary the conditions or the behavior or what the robot does and learn about that way. One of the first things that we did in terms of a collaborative enhancement to that existing kind of research was to add an interview protocol at the end and, you know, sit down with people at the end of the study. When a typical, you know, human-robot interaction type study would be over, say, bye, see ya, right? We wanted to sit with them for 15, 20 minutes and ask them about kind of what it was like. So we developed this structured interview protocol and analysis of those interviews. Yaoqing did was the author on a great paper that is about kind of understanding these things, understanding the different kinds of reactions that people have. And so for some participants that were familiar, maybe had seen robots because they took a robotics class, or, you know, these days, like, there are robots operating on UT's campus for research purposes. And so some students kind of like, oh, cool, it was a robot. It was really, really neat. I got to see the technology. It was very exciting. You know, I always wondered how these Boston Dynamics things, what they looked like or what they would sound like or things like that. Other participants would express some apprehension and describe that in different ways. And so one of the things, like the Boston Dynamics robots, they are very kind of biomorphic, right? They look like a canine. And so when they're walking and just when they're standing, their legs are kind of bent a little bit, right? And so one participant kind of said, like, in describing that initial state of kind of uncertainty, apprehension, it's like, I didn't know, you know, what could it jump on me, or all those things that you might, those same sorts of apprehensions that you might have when you encounter a dog of the same size, right? Absolutely. A dog that size, that distance from you could jump on you, right? And other participants didn't, you know, express that kind of apprehension. The ones that didn't tended to have some kind of prior, you know, possibility space of like, I know it's not going to do that. Or maybe like, I know that the researchers would never get that past the IRB. Certainly we had all sorts of safety protocols in place, so no one was in danger. Those are the kinds of specific things, right, that people would cite. And then we would want to go into understanding if that perception changed and if any part of the experimental design, when they would encounter this robot, when the robot would pass them. And then we also added a thing after they filled out all the surveys, right? So we did all the quantitative data collection, but then after that, because it's not, couldn't influence the results retroactively, as far as we know. Retrocausality is not an accepted phenomenon in HRI. It basically said, here's the robot. Do you want to touch it? Do you have any questions for us? And those were things that our team added to it because we just noticed that people wanted to touch the robots. In Yao Ching's analysis of these interview results, there were for people that had kind of an initial apprehension or any kind of uncertainty, there were two main points when people described an inflection point or a change in their experience, kind of like, okay, after that, I was like, okay, this is fine. The first one was when the robot, the experimental design was kind of a hallway that was 4 or 5 feet wide, right? And the participants started in the middle on one side, the robot started in the middle of the other, and the instruction was just walk to the other side and pass the robot however feels natural. The robot, they didn't know this, but the robot was programmed to basically take the alternative side of the hall within a certain distance, right? And so the moment when they got close enough to the robot that it altered its trajectory, that was cited as one of the inflection points. We're kind of like, okay, after that point, I saw that it was going to go to the opposite side of the hallway as I was in, right? And then I started feeling a little bit more like, okay, I know what's going to happen. And the other was participants, when they finally got to touch the robot, right? And it was just kind of standing there at the end, right? Kind of by the researchers and said, do you want to touch the robot? And other people talked about those two inflection points. And so that was great qualitative data that gives us a sense of when people's minds might change about these kinds of experiences. And in the first case, right, where the robot kind of changed course, it was perceiving maybe intuitively that the robot could do something and would do something, right? It got some information about the robot. In the touching, right, it's kind of a combination of I can do something, I can touch it, and it won't move, right? It will just let me touch it. That was a kind of an early study in our collaboration, but it's foundational in a lot of ways. The big conceptual or theoretical thing that we've investigated from a lot of different perspectives is agency, right? So these autonomous robots, they do things. When is that perceived as? When does that constitute a kind of agency? And for whom? Right? For people that knew more about robotics, they really viewed the robot as an extension of some unknown programmer. Right? Oh yeah, it was programmed to do that. That's why it did it. For people that didn't, that kind of perceived the robot as an agent itself, it was kind of discovering the contours of that agency that really helped them make sense of it. And a few participants kind of really, kind of like, I knew I was going to be creeped out. I'm still kind of creeped out. I don't like the way it looks. I'm glad I did the study, but, I'm not sure how I feel about robots, quadruped robots in general. Again, that's not representative kind of data, but it lets us ask better questions, right? And eventually some of the body language type things are, okay, well, if people kind of perceive, there's good evidence that people are perceiving this as a canine type entity, what are the things that that make people comfortable when encountering a dog? One of them is a leash. Other are the kind of like happy or relaxed or playful, body language, things like that. And so those become new experimental conditions that we can implement, that we have implemented and published on.
I'm Yeah, I find that whole thing so interesting. It brings to mind so many questions for me in that, like, number one, yes, it's obviously a very, very different scenario than someone encountering like a non-human entity. As you know, like
I will point out, and I'll put, this will go in my kind of tenure dossier because I have to get people to approve tenure in a few years, right? It technically is a form of non-human intelligence, artificial intelligence, as we talk and think about it, right? Yeah, robotic stuff. And so, yeah, it's interesting. What are the categories here? Please go on.
Yeah, no, exactly, and it's so it's, you know, there's this kind of talk in the kind of like UFO and experiencer community about what that means, and it means something, you know, kind of more specific. But at the same time, like, we is entirely separate from that. We as humanity are like bringing into being these non-human intelligences that we're then interacting with. And it might not be quite as shocking because I at least have a category in my brain that's like marked robot. And even if it's like the Jetsons is what you're thinking, at least you have something. You know, but at the same time, I do think that there's probably a lot to be learned there from how people feel, like what are the factors in them being comfortable, what they project onto it, like what they assume is going on versus what's actually going on. And it also makes me wonder, like, if you were another kind of intelligence that was trying to figure out how to communicate with humanity, like what kind of experiments might you subject them to? Like, what might they be trying to figure out about us and what we like to interact with and what makes us comfortable? And, you know, just highly speculative stuff, but it's fun to think about.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, kind of the lack of certainly shared vocabulary, but in some cases, potentially shared experience points, it kind of gets to this kind of situation. If you imagine, you know, being separated by, you know, a screen or a sheet or something, right? Where you could make impressions of some form, but you don't really know what it looks like from the other side. And then kind of things come out, but you're also not sure, like, is that just the reverberation or like, is that kind of a causal consequence of something you pushed in here and something pushes out here? Is that just the nature of the little thing that separates you, or is that a reaction from some entity? Right? There's a lot of complex inference that has to happen to communicate across radically different experience types. One thing, you know, I haven't published anything on this, but, you know, I'm reading with great interest the work of Michael Levin, and he's talked about the research program of diverse intelligences. And I think that's something that I haven't seen applied to the, you know, experiencer space or UAP space. Certainly, it's nicely adjacent. The Active Inference Institute, Carl Friston's group, is I think doing a great job getting the kind of conceptual tools and formalisms out to investigate these in a very transdisciplinary type way, and the idea of kind of needing to make inferences with a fundamental kind of gap in information, right? This information theoretic gap is something that, you know, in terms of Levin's work, is just characteristic of all life. He kind of makes the argument that all intelligence is collective intelligence. And so the study of intelligence is the study of arrangement of collectivities. And right, he can do all sorts of really wonderful things that are very legible to biologists. He's a morphogeneticist, studies bioelectricity and how it governs how multicellular organisms achieve their shape through growth. But then, you know, in a kind of a separate publication, theoretical publication scheme, he really explores the implications of that experimental work that he's done. So that's a good example of how, you know, academia as a whole really needs this kind of mutual understanding to get ideas and to get tools to deal with these hard problems. I think that's what we do at our best. We just maybe haven't done it as broadly as I would like to see. And I think we can change that.
Oh, absolutely. One other question I had is, when because you were talking about instances where sometimes like a human being has to be at least partially controlling the robot's movements. Do you see a difference in how people respond when, like, do people notice that? Is that something that, like, comes out in the data at all? Or do people not really know the difference when it's just kind of performing on its own versus when it's being assisted?
Well, so there are studies, not that we have done, but I know they exist in the literature. I'll have them off the top of my head, where the perception of control is a study variable. Mm-hmm. And so the kind of seeing someone with the joystick, right, versus not seeing someone with the joystick might be a study variable to try and understand how, you know, the perception of autonomy really factors in. But I would say in the Wizard of Oz method, it's a factor of rigor that the participant doesn't know, right? That they can't tell. And so if a participant could tell or is kind of suspicious, right, that's just a bad wizard. And so there's skill, right, to make the robot look like it's acting autonomously. And you want to do that as reproducibly and as, well, I was going to say transparently, but really it's opaquely as possible, right, in terms of how the robot's being controlled. Because the whole purpose of it is you want to put someone in the experience of autonomy or system capability that you have kind of shimmed in so that you can study it before you have to build it. And in human-computer interaction, which is closer to the kind of background that I had before this collaboration, that could be things like, you know, before, you know, ChatGPT or things like that, you know, you could make, you could have tell someone that they were chatting with a bot, but really it was, right, it was a person who was composing the responses to kind of simulate what it would be like if a system could do those things. There were also studies in search, right? Information retrieval studies where you're trying to build a search engine and people would, you know, kind of put it in a thing. And I don't know, you might have, in those cases, you know, it might take a little more time, right? So you put the little spinner on there and you go have a team that's like getting it together and then sending across, okay, to kind of simulate what if the system was able to respond to this query in that way. And that informs kind of whether it's worth trying to build that thing. So in that case, we haven't done, I'm trying to think. Oh, well, so one study we did have, one of the study conditions, so it was the robot kind of by itself walking through the hallway, the robot kind of on a leash with one of the researchers with it, the robot walking next to a researcher with a joystick, right? Those kind of different conditions. And we didn't get a statistically significant difference from those different conditions. In every case, so this is an opposite from the Wizard of Oz almost, right? In every case, the robot was operating autonomously. But what we were trying to see is what the kind of conditions of having a person there, right? And the kind of implied kind of control or responsibility of a leash or control of having a researcher with a joystick in their hands, as opposed to just a researcher walking next to the robot, suppose the robot by themselves. And in the, you know, I think it was 20, 25 participants, it takes a long time to do these studies, so you don't get kind of large N on them. We didn't get statistically significant, quantitative results for that. But we did get amazing insights out of the interviews that happened after that study, where the presence of a human was comforting, right? That knowing that, okay, there's a person there and the person doesn't see, you know, you can kind of infer from the existence of a person, their behavior, you have more kind of touch points to figure out what's going on than it's when it's just the robot by itself. And so in that case, you know, it was the same kind of programming in the robot every time. But we were doing the reverse Wizard of Oz of, like, when there was a person with a joystick walking next to the robot, we were implying that they were controlling it, even though they weren't.
There's just so much in there. I love talking about this stuff. I think it makes me think of with encounters with grays. Like, I've never had an encounter with a gray. But you hear in people's stories so much this idea that, like, there are certain ones of them, particularly the shorter ones, that people
robotic,
have.
Robotic, yeah.
Yeah, that they feel like they're robotic or something. And I'm like, so what is it, though, that's, I've always wondered, like, what is it exactly that's giving people that feeling, especially in a situation where they're like, well, this one seemed like it was a real entity, right? And these other ones seemed like they were drones. Like, so what was the difference between them that caused right. that perception, you know?
Right. And, you know, yeah. So that's a great example of a research question that we won't ask in the beginning, but that hopefully, you know, this kind of research infrastructure, availability of data, will let someone else ask as soon as they have time to, and potentially, hopefully we could get to it, right? Kim's kind of phenomenological method would be an excellent way to array the data, right? Of like when people describe a being as robotic, what are the kind of the phenomenological roots of that, mm-hmm. right? That co-occur with that kind of description. Also, are there any other terms beside robotic, stilted, stiff? I don't know. We'd have to look, right? Because the someone using the word robotic, right, is a behavior, but the theoretical construct of robotic-like beings might be broader than just those instances where someone used that term. So we want to make sure to get all that together. But then, yeah, what are the characteristics kind of underneath that? And one of the things that I would probably bring to that kind of table of inquiry is there are kind of studies about human perceptions of each other. We call each other robotic at times. We call ourselves robotic at times. Just, you know, sometimes, you know, we say, oh, they're a machine as a form of compliment, right? And so all of those things could help us interpret kind of the lived experience, the lived meaning of, you know, those kind of phenomenal roots and then that interpretation of robotic and what that might mean. And we don't know, right, whether is it possible that those beings are incapable of the affective type things that we would expect and that we would demand of things to not call them robotic. In some cases, it's certainly, you know, that I'm kind of aware of and I've heard just kind of anecdotally, it does seem like there's a characteristically different kind of lack of empathy or understanding or things like that. But those are the pieces that we need to tease out. Furthermore, you know, I fully expect that the terms that we have right now, it's about like almost like trying to do biology without a conception of what, you know, species or genera of, you know, without a meaningful way to group things, right? And so you could kind of say, you know, I don't know, the thing with wings, but there are a lot of things with wings and you haven't yet, right? You haven't yet kind of isolated something that you could say some, you know, unless you're kind of doing the kind of raw ability to use wings to fly, although not all winged things can fly. You just see what I'm saying, right? When we get down to these kind of categories of like short gray beings, I fully expect that there's going to be, we haven't yet kind of really isolated a thing that we would be able to say meaningful things about just yet. And we'll try and do that.
Well, this has been such a fun conversation. The first 60 minutes has absolutely flown by.
Yeah.
Elliot and I are going to keep talking for a little bit longer over on the members only site. So if you'd like to hear the rest of our conversation and you're not already a member, you can sign up at unknowncountry.com. Elliot, before we say goodbye to everyone and head over to the other section, can you let people know just like where to find you? Anything you want to share?
Absolutely. Sure. So you can, you know, see my website, ElliotHauser.com, 2 L's, 2 T's. And also our Archives of the Impossible, impossiblearchives.rice.edu. And if there's not a kind of mailing list that you could sign up for at, you know, impossiblearchives.rice.edu, you could certainly send something to, I believe it's impossiblearchives@gmail.com, but the email address is on there and be requested to be added to that list. We'll have that up. That'll be one of the places that we distribute updates from that project.
Awesome. Well, can't wait to see where all that heads. All right. We'll say goodbye to everybody and continue on in just a minute.
Thanks, y'all. Thank you for the opportunity to talk about the robotics research. You know,
oh, I love that stuff.
I do think it is relevant in a way that I haven't yet kind of had the time or occasion to write down, but that is in my future. So thank you for that.
No, of course. As soon as you were talking about it, like, I mean, the archive stuff is interesting, but in some ways, like, the robotic stuff is even more interesting to me because it's, we don't have a lot of ways to ask some of these questions. And although it's not perfect, it's like also kind of closer than you would, it's a pretty good, it's a pretty good stand-in for that kind of.
And hopefully it functions as an example of the kind of research, I mean, you know, okay, maybe through synchronicities or whoever, you know, like that just happens to be particularly applicable. But I think there are more researchers with more kinds of interesting research capabilities and interests that can and should find the things that they study in experiencers and in UAPs. I think that's really great. And hopefully any academics that are kind of watching from the sidelines, trying to figure out, you know, how and whether they can, you know, add this to their research programs, maybe there's some inspiration there.
I think there are. I joke that I'm HR for the phenomenon because I hear from so many people all the time who email me and are like, I really want to do this, but I don't know what to do. But and they're often very serious people. They're very often academics and people who really could contribute, but they just like don't know where to. They just don't know where to start. And I'm like, I don't know. Just I know this sounds crazy, but just like tell, set the intention that you want to help, and I swear you'll be put to work.
Well, you know, so I've been participating in online communities of experiences, as I kind of indicated. And, you know, I kind of read this whole, you know, CE5 thing, you know, Close Encounters 5, right, where you human-initiated contact. And actually, you know, what you do is you just, you meditate and then you form like a very pure and kind of heartfelt intention and just kind of send it out and then kind of forget about it. And so, you know, I was kind of like, you know, this is before I could even figure out how this could mesh with my research or whatever, just more just kind of like coming to terms with, okay, this is a thing. These are people like, oh my gosh, right. This is life. and trying to get a sense of like, okay, so like, what is the intention that I can hold, you know, with this kind of true sincerity type thing? Cause I was convinced by, you know, kind of people that I'd read that, you know, intention was a key piece to it. And so I had to kind of do that inquiry. And so my kind of intention that I kind of put out there, you know, I have a meditative practice and things like that, but, you know, kind of, it was mutual understanding. And right, I could put that out, kind of say like, that was the thing I found in myself, right? That like, if I see someone who sincerely wants to understand themselves or me or whatever, right? Like I want to understand everything I can. And when I find someone else, right, some person or intelligence of any kind, right, that has something like that, like I can pick that up and I can run with that. And like, that's my thing, right? And then here I am talking to Kelly Chase, you know, a little bit over a year later and all that sort of stuff. Right. So, I guess maybe that's an advertisement for your advice to people that reach out to you of kind of like, how do I get involved? Well, I mean, if you're not going to hang back and wait for the proof that is going to be redundant by the time it arrives, right?
Yeah.
If you're willing to kind of say, okay, well, what are the things that we would expect to be the case if some of these things are the case, then it would be something like, oh yeah, well, like meditation and this kind of spiritual personal growth, all that sort of stuff are central to it. And so this idea of kind of reaching out with pure intention or something like that, is a component of it. So, if you think that this is worth your time for inquiry, then that's a great place to start. I don't hold kind of firm beliefs on things. You know, I'm not part of religious studies. One of the things I love and I've learned and kind of taken on from Jeff Kripal and Danny Pasulka and religious studies in general is like, you know, we don't have beliefs. We study belief. And same kind of thing of like, I don't claim to, I don't need to have to be settled on what the interpretation of that was, but I did a meditation in February or March, 2024. And before that, I prepared and I thought, and I was like, what is the thing that like really defines me, or the thing that I, that I could send out? Cause I don't know. It's not like wealth and fame. I don't know. I'm not trying to manifest something, some monster, like there's a lot of, kind of almost like fairy tale kind of pitfalls of like, I don't want to be King Midas or any of the kind of cautionary tales of like, know what you really are asking for. Like, yeah, mutual understanding. Like I'm willing to die on that hill. Let's go for it.
Yeah, no, that's a great one. It makes me think. So my brother is a doctor, and he told me a few months ago, hopefully he wouldn't mind me sharing this, but that something that he started doing that like changed his practice and changed everything about the way his days went is that he started stopping outside the door before he would walk in to see the patient, and just like clearing his mind for a second. And then in his mind, visualizing, like giving this person like a big, like a very warm handshake, and like before he walked in, and that like that changed the energy in how people receive him and how, willing they are to listen and like how defensive they are. And just like his whole day would go easier with people. And I think that, I think that that's what the phenomenon, I think that's how the phenomenon works. I think that's how everything works in a way, is that like how you choose to show up to something really influences like then what unfolds. And the phenomenon, because it's so kind of weird and abstract and kind of like not bound by the rules of our everydayness, I think it just, it becomes more maybe obvious or something that that's what's going on, just because it's so strange. But I think a lot of our life works that way, is like that the intentions that you set end up creating the container in which whatever happens is going to happen. And that like defines a lot from the beginning.
Right. Yeah. It's funny. One of the kind of methods that I use is called grounded theory. And one of the kind of dicta or, conventional wisdom type things of grounded theory is all is data. And it's very much, it's designed so that, your personal experience and what people say in an interview and what you see ethnographically or what you read, like all of those things are kind of candidates to be woven together into a new understanding of something that's hard to understand. I say that maybe to introduce, like, this is not maybe as random as it's going to sound. One of the things that we ask in that kind of mode is what else would we expect to be true if this is true? And that's a good way of kind of testing the resilience or transferability of an existing understanding. And so, the things that you're saying about like the importance of visualizing how something's going to go before you walk into a room, maybe that connection to this, these practices, meditative practices of manifestation, or these kind of communicative, human initiated, communicative things. What else would we expect to be true? Well, one of the things I would expect to be true is for high performing people, especially in creative fields, to utilize these practices, right? Because this exists, then holy moly, like, wouldn't that would be amazing if you were an artist or a writer, or maybe even an athlete. And just so happens that there's all sorts of, these kind of idiosyncratic things, these kind of like mental toughness type constructs that come up in sports, or these kind of what Diana Pasulka started investigating, protocols of creativity for kind of artists and creatives, or, and also mathematicians, weirdly, right? And so interesting, right? Like, great. Like if we see like nothing in those fields, we're totally right. It's kind of like, that's BS, right? Kind of internally, they're like, that's BS, right? Then it'd be like, I wonder why, right? It's not that you reject it, right? It's kind of like, I wonder what the additional factor is. But the interesting thing is that, the way that this kind of like sports psychology is one of the ways that it's rendered from the outside of just like, these athletes and these coaches, I don't know, Phil Jackson, the Zen master, ha ha ha, it's so weird, you know, whatever. They have these kind of rituals that they go through, you know, great athletes go through the same ritual. LeBron James gets to the, you know, the thing, or, you know, Seth Curry always puts this sock on and then that sock, whatever it is. And it's kind of just seen as these weird idiosyncrasies from the outside. But from the inside, from the people that really are at the top of their games, like that's a core piece of that they attribute to their success, right? And so it is, there's these kind of connections and unconnected places. The vocabularies are very different. And that's, to me, that's evidence. You're saying like people ask for evidence, they don't know what evidence is. Like this is evidence, right? Of these kind of unconnected places. And so when we use things like intention or energy, right? It's easy to kind of stand on the outside and say, have the similar kind of thing of like, oh, whatever, you're just fooling yourself, like LeBron James. Like, really, right. Though? And so one of the importance of kind of participatory research methods is to get in and get first-person experience with some of these things. And then to bring the kind of connections that we can make as researchers to bear upon it. So I say energy, right? There's all this stuff like energy workers and things like that. And the kind of Western null hypothesis is that that's all psychosomatic, right? There's kind of like, no, nothing, right? But actually, you know, in Chinese medicine, the concept of qi, right, is this kind of energy that you can kind of shape and move around and kind of achieve these very extraordinary physiological and physical effects from, you know, the Western null hypothesis would be like, ah, it's all BS, right? They're all fooling themselves. But just so happens that this hasn't really made the news for some reason. It hasn't made the consciousness for, right? Just so happens that there's a whole new circulatory system that has been discovered in the past decade or so.
Oh.
Right? These kind of, it's separate from blood vessels. It's separate from the lymph system. There are these very, very fine kind of capillary type networks that just so happen to align with where you would expect, you know, some anatomical correlate to qi to be, right? And I forget what the term is.
Is it like our humors?
Well, yeah, right. I mean,
that's kind of cool, amazing. Though.
Yeah, exactly. And so instead of the kind of null hypothesis that renders like most of the world, you know, just diluted, it's a little bit, I don't know, it's just more fruitful and a better world to live in to kind of be like, huh, well, I wonder, and to maybe go look. And so the discovery, and again, like there's not even like these are in mainstream scientific journals. There's all sorts of stuff where people have done, because it takes a very fine kind of microscopic technique of dissection to kind of tease out these capillary type things, right? And what the what kind of fluids are in them? Well, it's, I don't know. Most of it's like DNA and RNA. That's weird kind of stuff. And there's just so many connections. So I think it's we don't live in a space of wonder enough. And that, I don't know. To me, as someone in who joined academia, like a lot of us, I think, right, from a place of inquiry and wonder, that's a deep irony that sometimes inside, but often outside academia, it's seen and used as this tool to quash wonder. And yet when you read the literature, it's like all these amazing discoveries that, you know, it's like how could for hundreds of years, how could an entire circulatory system go unnoticed? Well, it didn't go unnoticed, right? It just wasn't called a circulatory system. It was, you know, investigated in these terms of these energy and qi and all these sorts of things. And those have real correlates. Those weren't people fooling themselves, right?
Yeah, it makes me think of, you know, it's some kind of quote. It's something like, millionaires don't believe in astrology, but billionaires do, which, like, I'm not here to argue for convince people of astrology. That's a whole other can of worms. But you know, there does seem to be, to speak to a lot of what you're saying, you know, among the elite, among high performing athletes, among, you know, top scientists and all of that, there seems to be this greater awareness that we are able to access information non-locally, that we're able to tap into things beyond just the material, and that the ability, and that is extraordinarily valuable in terms of making decisions and sort of like guiding the things that you do and even determining outcomes. And yet, like, that's not what the everyday person is taught in school. There's like almost like a separation there that I find really fascinating, and that and then I think that like a lot of cool things could happen if more people had that awareness. It's almost like the secret that they keep at the top, or you stumble onto it by accident, but it's not being like shared with most people.
Right. I'm really excited to see what else comes out of Diana Pasulka's investigation of this. Also, when the talks from Archives of the Impossible come out, Hussein Ali Agrama, who's an anthropologist at the University of Chicago, made, I think, just an amazing and impassioned kind of call for academia to rise to this challenge, right? He talked about new methods of perception and talked about the mathematician, kind of early 20th century mathematician, Ramanujan, who really kind of described his experience of an avatar of the goddess Lakshmi coming to him in dreams and giving him these mathematical insights that he was able to kind of work out, right? And he was like brought to Cambridge, you know, kind of like, well, who is this guy, right? It's amazing kind of stuff. And seriously, one of the world's greatest mathematicians, right? I think Hussein's kind of call, and this is why we need all of the kind of richness of academia brought to bear on this, is like, as an anthropologist, like, he wants to get in and do it. Like, can we do this? How do we do it? Let's do it. Let's see these new methods of perception. And then let's do it together. This new kind of social phenomenology of how do our experiences, how are they shaped by being in groups? I'm just like, Hussein, anywhere, like, you lead the charge. I'll be right after you, man. Let's do it.
He's awesome. That was a great talk. I'd like to, before we wrap up, something we talked about a little bit before we started recording is just sort of this idea of what is an experiencer and what it means to identify as one. And so let's start with, like, do you identify as an experiencer?
Well, you know, I hesitate to, right? So I'm certainly not a contactee. I'm not an abductee. Right. Like, I don't have premonitions. Right. There are a lot of things that I can say, definitely not. Right. But I want to walk this line between having a deep respect for the importance of the term, right, as a way for people that have experiences that are just shocking, right, that need integration, that they kind of can't. They haven't been able to be understood, and then they find this experiencer community, and it's like, okay, now I found my kind of place. I don't want them to show up to a space like that and, you know, kind of just feel like there are people there who are devaluing the term, right? So I defer to and give great respect to the term. I'm also sympathetic to the possibility that, right, the implication of experiencers' experiences is about the nature of consciousness, the nature of being in general, right? And so some experiencers, you know, kind of say, like, well, I think we're all experiencers. Like, there's differences to it, right? There's things that that kind of show up as things that are difficult to explain and that other people won't accept and that offer challenges. But there's something about this that's the nature of human experience. So in that sense, I don't want to be in the front of any line. But I also, you know, I'm kind of open to and want to investigate, like, what does this mean if we're all experiencers to a certain extent?
Yeah, I think that's so important. I think for a lot of reasons, I'm kind of a weird case, because as I was coming to terms with being an experiencer, I was also surrounded by, like, I guess what people would call, like, super experiencers. And so I had experiences like I've had precognitive events. I've lived in a haunted house. I mean, I got a phone call from my dad 3 months after he died that gave me, like, very specific information about someone that I didn't have otherwise. So, like, I've had these, but compared to people who have, like, been abducted, I'm like, I don't know that mine really count. Like, my little experiences. I don't know do I count that, you know? And But I do think, like, speaking to what you're saying, like, I do think that there is both something valuable about experiencers being able to identify as that and being able to speak with each other and to find community and to find support, because you're kind of like living this dual stream life where there's consensus reality that you have to continue to exist within, but then you have mm-hmm. this other understanding that only a certain percentage of other people seem to have. And like, so there's all of the considerations that go along with that. And like at conferences and stuff, there's always at least one person who comes up to me so emotional because they're just like, this is the first time I've been around other people who have, and just right. to be able to say out loud for the first time the things that they haven't been able to say aloud before it's so powerful. The flip side of that I also see though, is that then experiencer becomes like this club that certain people are in and other people aren't in. There's sometimes this weird hierarchy that develops where it's like, well, these people are like closer to the phenomenon, which is almost analogous to being like closer to God or something. Like there's, you know, and that is, I don't think people do that necessarily intentionally. I think it's just like the way humans are wired. And if, especially for people who are very interested in these experiences or wish that they were having more experiences like that, it can feel that way, like being left out of a club or something. But then there's the other side of it, which is that I agree with you. And I think that like, we're all experiencers and that like, you know, nothing human is alien to me. Right. And mm-hmm. so how do we open that door further? Because I do think that that's where this is going, is that like in the long term that this hopefully is evolving into an understanding that we're all experiencers in some sense or another. So yeah, it's complicated. And it seems like in some ways we'd almost need to get to the point where more people recognize that they're experiencers to get to like all the work that's being done right now is so foundational and important, but be able to do kind of more extended studies and to get like deeper into it, you almost need for people across the spectrum to be able to like identify as experiencers in a way.
Right. Yeah. The other thing that I said is like, we are very familiar with these kind of identity dynamics, but there aren't necessarily, you know, cut and paste analogs. So you take something like sexuality, right? There's heteronormativity, there's homosexuality, there's bisexuality, pansexuality, things like that. And so if someone comes up and is like, well, sexuality is a spectrum or something like that, I'd be like, okay, but you're in a heterosexual relationship. Does that mean that, you know, that person is, you know, that you might otherwise, you know, be in a relationship of another gender? Well, that would be an application potentially of sexuality being a spectrum. But also sexuality being a spectrum totally erases the possibility of asexual people, mm-hmm. right? Where it's kind of like, and there's different kinds of asexual people. Some people feel aversive to sexuality. Some people don't. Some people, you know, have romantic interests, but not sexual. Some people are aromantic, asexual. So, right, there's a lot of different terms that develop that try to make space for a different way of being. And at its worst, right, those terms separate us further.
Right.
But it can be hard sometimes because the term makes space, but it also potentially makes a separation. And so this is, you know, it's not a solved problem, but certainly there's some sophisticated literatures and dialogues that have happened in other spaces that I think we could bring to bear on this. There are studies of kind of in-group, out-group type behaviors in sociology. That's kind of a foundational thing. And there are certain, you know, groups need to be kind of semi-permeable. They need to have clear, you know, okay, this person is in, this person is out, but they don't need to be dismissive or kind of harm people or kick people out or things like that. But they do need to kind of defend bad actors or, you know, be able to kind of say, enforce norms. And so we're into familiar ground for a sociologist or in some cases anthropologists. I hope that as these communities kind of form and that we can not start from scratch at least, right? It's not like there's a magic wand to be, you know, kind of like, okay, now everybody's happy and accept each other. But there are certainly kind of more and less efficient ways to get there.
Oh, absolutely. And I think that the comparison to sexuality is actually a really apt one, because like it seems to I've had that same thought that like there's a lot of the same problems. Like God forbid we wade into the gender debate, because I don't even want to deal with those emails. But there are similar problems, right? Where like in terms of categorizing things, and like if it's something doesn't include everyone, all right, now what do we do? And like how do we, you know, you can oversimplify things, but you can also like open things up to the point that like words become meaningless, and it's hard to know how to categorize things that are so deeply human and so deeply personal that it becomes difficult to like put structures around it. That and you can put structures around it, but to the extent to which those structures represent truth is difficult to measure. And so I find that really interesting. And I think it's just like a lot of, you know, we have the same problems with like the term UFO or like UAP. Like, I mean, both are loaded, both are flawed. And then we also, and somehow, you know, we're still just using one or two words or these like imperfect terms to describe something that has almost probably countless iterations and manifestations and ways that they occur and the effects that it has on people. And we're just using this like one clunky, ham-fisted word to refer to it because we just don't have a better way yet. But hopefully over time we will.
I would say the there's been political kind of interest in critical race theory right here at University of Texas at Austin. A lot of people haven't ever read it or really know what it is, but this comes from a Black feminist community in like late 80s, early 90s. A lot of, I mean, still to today, right? But the concept of intersectionality of identity is really helpful. That comes from a Black feminist scholar of law named Kimberly Crenshaw. And what she was doing is, the kind of core case that she developed the term, the legal concept of intersectionality around, was a court case where I believe it was General Motors basically needed to do layoffs, and they ended up firing basically all of their Black female employees, right? And people sued, said, "What are you talking about?" And General Motors said, "Well, no, we didn't fire Black female employees. We fired employees in certain categories where women were likely to work, and there was a seniority cutoff." But that was in the 60s when it was legal to discriminate and not hire Black people specifically, right? And so none of the women who worked for General Motors could possibly have attained that seniority because they were able to be legally discriminated against before that, right? And so the argument, right, the court basically said, no, GM didn't do anything wrong, right? Because there's protection for being Black. And there's protection for being a woman, and nothing was violated here. They said, no, we're doing layoffs based on seniority. And the fact that a Black woman couldn't have been hired to meet that seniority, right, was kind of like just kind of like a weird optical illusion for the court, right? And so Crenshaw, and this was, 20 years later or so that Crenshaw was talking about intersectionality in a legal context, but it's been very influential in talking about how the like all of us know that aspects of our identity that people treat us as influence who we are. It's not who we are, right? But like people see me in identity categories, right? I can't control that, and that's real, right? There's an intersection of different identities that I have to kind of reckon with, and that is that's a wonderful tool, right, for being able to not overfit, right, not collapse me down to some facet of my identity, and to not say, okay, Black, this is a central category of Black person. This is a central category of even Black woman, right? But there are many, many different kind of intersections that kind of shape the experience of being a unique individual, and that we need to be real about, but that never kind of totally exhaust it. And so a similar kind of sophistication, I think, could really help. Experiential studies also you know, that idea that I was saying, kind of like, do we really know what we're talking about when we say tall gray, short gray, tall white, mantis being, you know, like, right? It's just like more information needed in all of those cases. Similar to, you know, if I just list off demographic categories, I'm not yet talking about people, you know?
I think that's such a great point and such a great place for us to leave it for today. Elliot, it
thank
has
you
been
so much.
Oh my gosh, thank you so much. This has been so much fun and I really appreciate your time. This was just a blast having a chat with you.
Likewise. Thank you so much.
You've been listening to Dreamland. Be sure to tune in again next week. Dreamland is brought to you by UnknownCountry.com and its family of subscribers. Our theme music is The O of Pleasure by Ray Lynch. Unknown Country was founded by Ann Streber. Our news editor is Matthew Frizzell. Our coordinator is Amy Safrankova. Whitley Streber is your Dreamland host. And I'm your announcer, Ted Alexander.